This is Emotion Art. If you haven't yet, I suggest that you read the book No Bad Parts by Richard Schwartz. It's the internal family systems parts work model of psychotherapy, and it has been life-changing for me. 4 years ago, I attended my first silent retreat with a teacher named Justin Michelson. Justin's the guy that introduced me to parts work. He teaches people to just sit with the quiet, sit with the pain, get to know the family of feelings that makes up who they are. Justin's retreats really feel like spending time with that one friend who doesn't say much, but makes you feel fully seen. Super transformative. Justin's practice blends mindfulness and self-compassion with super gentle humor in nature spots where you feel like you're shielded from all the noise, even the internal noise. From the book he just released, The Dharma of Healing, it's clear that Justin is all about uncovering that hidden love and wisdom that we as a species have kind of forgotten we are. It's like a gentle wake-up call. His philosophy is super kind and very poetic. It really welcomes trauma to a seat by the fire. So, if you're craving that kind of honest connection with yourself, check out justinmichelsondharma.com, JustinMichelsonDharma.com. Or follow him at Justin Michelson Dharma. I found the best community starts with shutting up and listening. And a silent retreat is the perfect place to start that practice. Or deepen it. Follow Justin on his socials. Join a retreat. Grab the book. Do something for the family inside you. Justin, thank you for sharing your art. It's made all the difference in my life. Okay, this is a conversation I had with Steve Gregg, who is a Christian apologist. He's a family connection from way back, and he was the founder of a discipleship Bible school that I went through. He seemed like somebody who thinks his own thoughts, and often. So I wanted to see what the world looks like from his perspective. This conversation reminds me of the previous conversation I had with the Orlo titled Why God Anyway? Just from a Christian perspective rather than an atheist perspective. I really appreciate Steve taking the time out of his busy radio broadcast and itinerant teacher life to record a conversation with me about what really matters in life. If this stirs any thoughts or opinions in you, please leave a comment here on the podcast or on our socials. And as always, I hope you find joy in this conversation.
Welcome to Emotion Art.
Emotion Art, where we sit down and make art
with our emotions.
Emotion Art.
Creative energy moving outward in conscious expression of feeling.
Emotion Art.
Emotion because we are literally made of emotion. Art because everything we do wants to be art. Emotion Art feels.
Emotion Art. It's all beautiful. Emotion art.
A space for emotional art. Creative energy moving outward in conscious expression.
Emotion art.
An emotion art gallery.
This is emotion art.
You're welcome. I'm going to start recording.
All right.
Huh? And then we'll just edit. Yeah. We edit heavily. Yeah, we're still just learning how to do this, but it's so fun.
Now your folks live in Bandon still, right?
Yeah, my folks live in Bandon. A lot of the younger generation still, in fact, no, not all of them. Some of them live in the outlying area, but in that general area, they all do.
And you live where?
Corvallis,
okay, great.
Yep, do you know Corvallis?
I have spoken there before. I lived in Albany for a while, which is only 10 miles from there.
Okay.
But, boy, you look an awful lot like your dad.
Yeah. I sound a lot like him. My handwriting looks a lot like his.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and you and my dad go way back.
We do.
To my understanding.
We do, in fact.
How
do we get connected?
What's your connection? Yeah.
I ran a Bible school in Bandon on Beach Loop Road.
The Great Commission School.
Yeah, that was the Great Commission School. And your dad? Your dad was in the Portland area at a time when some of our people went up there for a street outreach. And your dad was with a few other people from the Jim Roberts group. And, some of our people ran into him at a street market doing evangelism in Portland. This would have been back in the 80s. I don't remember the exact year. Probably, I'm thinking 86, maybe, is realistic.
Mm.
Our people and your dad hit it off well, and your dad became curious to know about our school. So he came down to Bandon with some people, or the people he was kind of leading around, and they stayed with us, I think, for a week or two, and then they moved on because they were kind of nomadic. But we liked them, and he liked us, and actually there was some difference between the Jim Roberts group and my views about a divorce and remarriage. I was myself divorced and remarried. And your dad was divorced, but he thought he couldn't remarry. That's before he married Teresa. And he and I had a discussion about it, which was recorded on cassette tape. And I guess I convinced him that he was free to remarry given his circumstances. And he remained in the Jim Roberts group for a while, but not very long after that. The tape got around in the Jim Roberts group, and I became persona non grata with the group. But your dad left the group and married Teresa, and then eventually they moved to Bandon, I guess probably to be near us, or else they just liked it when they saw it when it came out. And he became a plumber. But I'm pretty sure he was mentored in plumbing by one of our guys, Howard's his first name.
Howard O'Connor.
Well, Howard O'Connor, yeah. Howard O'Connor initially, because Howard had become a plumber also under Todd Powers. Todd Powers had taught Howard. And Howard's the one who met your dad in Portland originally and brought him over. And so your dad your dad relocated to Bandon because we were there, and he became a plumber there. And I think Howard had a business and left it with your dad. When Howard left town, he gave the business to your dad. So that's how we became acquainted. And your dad and I always had a lot in common. We had some theological things different, but we enjoyed sparring about them. But
yeah,
he's a great guy.
Yeah. Okay. So when you say your people, like what was the group or what was the, was it just organized around the Great Commission School it a big part of a different thing?
Well, the organization was called the Great Commission Community. I had come up from California, from Santa Cruz, and started the school because my father-in-law donated the property to us. And I had been an elder at Calvary Chapel, Santa Cruz, and teaching there.
Okay.
And I had run discipleship schools in Santa Cruz previous years. And so my father-in-law asked if I wanted a campus to run to school. And so I did move up there, and I brought with me about 8 people from the Calvary Chapel there and our first student body. We ran a school. I taught through the whole Bible in 9 months every year with different students. And some of our students came up from the Calvary Chapels the first year. The second year, fewer were from Calvary Chapel and others were from other places. And then we ran the school for 6 years in Bandon. Then we ended up having to sell the property because we couldn't, the donor hadn't owned it outright and he couldn't pay it off. So we had to, after 6 years, leave Bandon. We moved the school to McMinnville, had another property, and we ran it there for 10 years. We closed it in 99. But we were in Bandon from 83 to 89. And I was running the school down. We incorporated as the Great Commission Community, because we really wanted to start a Christian community that ran a school. Mm-hmm. But as it turned out, the school was the main thing we did. We lived in a community, but we ran a school. So
most of it out of the Calvary Chapel arena?
Well, it started out, my theology was different than Calvary Chapel's right from the beginning. And I was not dispensational, and Calvary is. But I was on good terms with the Calvary Chapel at Santa Cruz. I was one of the elders there. And they sent us off with a laying on of hands to start the school in Oregon. But after the first year, it became clear that it was not going to be a school associated with Calvary Chapel because of my theology. And so we parted from Calvary Chapel on a very friendly basis. I mean, even after that, when we went independent, I still would visit the Calvary and they'd have me teach and stuff there. So Even though my theology was not Calvary Chapel, I was had a good relationship after I left. And I haven't really been a part of a Calvary Chapel since then.
Okay, so how did you meet Dad? Was it an interaction? Was he already in with the Jim Roberts group? Did he like try to witness to you? Or
He had been with the Jim Roberts group for a long time. I had never heard of the Jim Roberts groups, one of the groups out of the Jesus movement that I had not encountered before, though I'd encountered several that were kind of similar. And when he came,
okay,
he certainly didn't try to proselytize me to the group, but he did. I don't remember us having a lot of theological arguments. He didn't try to high pressure me. Of course, I was his host at the school. He was staying with us, and we probably did disagree about some things, but I don't remember anything significant except that divorce issue.
Yeah,
he and I kind of debated that for that cassette tape that was made. That was at our school. Just him and me, and there were some people sitting around listening. Mm. And he was very receptive to what I had to say, I thought, and he himself changed his mind on that, it appears. Mm. As I understand, because I met someone else later from the Jim Roberts group who said that that tape had circulated in the group and had caused some people to leave it. I wasn't trying to get anyone to leave it.
Wow.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to get anyone to leave it, but I was just, I just saw it differently.
Yeah. What did you think of the group at that time when you first interacted with them?
I was always kind of semi-attracted to people who lived an alternative lifestyle in their Christian walk, radical Christians. I was a radical.
Especially communal.
Yeah. I was a pretty radical Christian myself. I felt that the Jim Roberts group was a bit cultic. I mean, what little I knew of it. Your dad didn't strike me as a cultic type of guy. I think he was a little more independent thinking, and that might have what caused him to eventually separate from them. But from what he told me of the group, a lot of what he told me about the group, I thought he was saying as a negative assessment of it. I wasn't sure, but it was kind of, it was kind of cultic and obviously fairly legalistic. And, when people become radical Christians, they want to go back to something, more biblical and less like institutional church. Their first stage usually is somewhat legalistic. Hopefully they grow out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a common transformation story.
Yeah.
So I've heard your name for my entire life, and I went to the Berean school, which I believe in some form or fashion came out of or after the Great Commission school.
Yeah, was John Maher leading that?
Yep, John Maher and John Kent.
Yeah, John Maher and John Kent were my own students in the Great Commission school at one point.
Okay.
And I moved the Great Commission school from Bandon to McMinnville in 1999. And I ran the Great Commission school there till, did I say 99? I moved there in 89 and moved from McMinnville to Idaho. I closed down the school in 99, moved to Idaho and lived there for a while. But when I left, John Maher and John Kent and a guy named John Rogers, I don't remember if you know him, three John, first, second, fourth John.
Yeah, nice. I've heard the name though.
Yeah, they were all Great Commission School alumni and they started up the same kind of program, same kind of school under the name Berean School in a house in McMinnville. And I came and taught in one of those years, but my wife, when I moved to Idaho, about 2 years after we moved to Idaho, my wife ran off and left me with four kids at home. And so I was a single dad trying to raise these four kids. I stepped out of the ministry for a while. When I did accept invitations to come speak at the Berean School later, my kids were, some of them were a little wild.
Yeah.
And I didn't have them under control. So we initially lived there at the Berean School. But because some of my kids were being kind of rebellious, it was deemed mutually desirable. Both the school and I both believed it'd be better for me to get lodging with my kids outside the school, which I did. Mm. And then my kids moved back to Idaho without me. And I had no reason that I had to stay in Oregon, so I moved back to Idaho to be close to them. So eventually, we all moved to Santa Cruz, California again, where I lived when I was younger. And then we all live in Southern California, the kids and me. But we don't live together. They're, of course, in their mid-30s, too. To 40.
Mm. So once you got out of, once you closed down the Great Commission School, I mean, what have you been doing since then? What does your life look like?
Well, before I closed the school down, I began the radio ministry that I still have called The Narrow Path.
Heard of that.
Well, when we were in McMinnville and I was running the school, after we'd been there for quite a few years, it was 1997, I had been sitting in as a guest host for a friend on his daily radio show. I sat in once a week so he could have a three-day weekend. So I was the Monday guest host of a two-hour talk show in Oregon. And after about, I don't know, five or more years of guest hosting for him, he said that he thought I should have my own show. I told him, well, I don't know anything about radio business. I was just sitting at the microphone answering Bible questions for callers. He said, well, I'll do the legwork for it. So he actually went to the station he was on, arranged for me to get an hour of my own, separate from his. And we started the Narrow Path, and it was on an hour a day. Let's see, the first year I was only on that one station. The next year I was on another station, too. In the first 4 years, I was on four stations. And then that's when my wife left me with kids. And so I went off the air because my marriage failed. And I was off the air for about a year. And a couple of the stations that I had been on before asked if I'd come back on. So I did. And then, you know, I've been on since then. So since 97, which is 28 years now. Yeah, I think 28 years now. I've been on the air.
It's always so much longer than it feels like it should be.
I know. It doesn't seem that long. 28 years.
Yeah.
Yep.
And now the further I get into my 40s, the faster everything is running.
That does that. It does that. How many kids do you have?
Yeah. Five boys with my wife and then two girls with my partner.
Okay. And how old are they all?
The oldest is 18. She's out in college already. Everyone else is either in high school or below.
Yeah.
With the youngest boy being, what is he now, 11? I don't want to guess too low. It's around there somewhere. It's interesting watching them all turn into like unique adults. It's crazy.
I know it. My oldest from my first marriage is 52 now. And that just sounds so...
How old are you?
I'm 72. So, I mean, that sounds old to me, but I don't feel old. I just...
And you don't look, or you have a heck of a filter on that webcam.
I don't have a filter on at all, but this is me.
So I guess I got to ask you, what's your skincare routine?
Well, the only thing I've done to my skin is remove a few basal cell carcinomas, but no, I don't do anything for my skin. I probably look older in person than on the camera, but I don't have any filters on.
Yeah.
Because I have a full head of hair, maybe that makes me not look as old as I am. But my dad had a full head of hair when he died at 95. My family has longevity.
And also, how stressful has your life been?
Well, let me put it this way. It has been very stressful during certain seasons.
Yeah.
I've had quite a few, the kinds of things that are said to be extremely stressful in people's lives. I've had quite a few of those. But on the other hand, I've never really felt at all abandoned by God. I mean, my faith has never, I've never had a crisis of faith of any kind. I've always wondered when I went through these crises, how people could do it without Christ. You know, I've been a follower of Christ since I was young, and I've been in marriage since I was 16. But yeah, I've had two wives leave me. I married when I was 20, and my first wife ran off. No, I married when I was 19. My child was born when I was 20. And then when I was 21, my child was 1 year old. My wife ran off with someone else and left me with a child. I was single for 6 years after that. I married again, and this time a good one. But my good wife was killed in an accident in 1980. She was hit by a truck, and we'd only been married for 6 months. And so
wow.
I was a single dad again with my child from my first marriage, who was seven then. And then... I was single for a few more years. I married a woman who seemed like a good woman, and we were married for 20 years. We had the four children that she left me with when she ran off, but her mother had a history of mental problems. She'd been in mental institutions twice before I knew her, and my wife began to have some kind of issues. She was a loyal wife and mother for most of 20 years, and then near the end, she began some issues. Mental issue, which she never, she didn't believe in doctors and things like that, so she wouldn't ever be treated or even evaluated. But everybody who knew her, including the kids, just say, well, she just went off the rails. And she just walked out, and she was so changed that she left the kids behind. She'd always been very protective over the kids and wouldn't let them out of her sight. She has never wished to speak to me since. Mm. You know, she just left the faith and left the family. And she has not had a good life since. I mean, things have not gone well for her, which I'm sorry to say. Mm. But she, last I heard, she hasn't really gotten any better. But I was single then with the four children she left me with for 10 years. And when the oldest was grown, I met my present wife. And there's been no trauma in that relationship. She's been a great wife. I've been married for 13 plus years. So I've had, you know, divorce, death of a spouse, infidelity on the part of my wife, the first wife, and insanity on the part of my second wife. I can speak lightly about those things somewhat now, but obviously the years that you're going through those things are stressful, very stressful.
Yeah. And how did you maintain balance? How did you not succumb to some sort of emotional complete breakdown or illness yourself? Or I don't know. How did you get through it?
Well, it was like? I never felt like I was near the edge of that. I was distraught. I was distraught when my marriage just failed. I have a high view of marriage, and my expectation was that I'd be married to the same person for life. And each time I remarried, I thought this was for life, but I've never ended a marriage myself.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I've walked with Jesus for, you know, 60 years, and I've known him. I mean, it's not like I just was indoctrinated in the Christian faith. I've known Christ. I've lived by faith. When I say by faith, I've never taken a salary. I don't have a newsletter. I don't let my needs be known to anybody. And for over, you know, about 55 years living this way, God has provided all my needs. I've seen dramatic answers to prayer. My experience with God is such that it would be almost impossible for me to have any doubts about it. But also, from the earliest time of my Christian life, I was aware, as some people are never told this, but I read books like Fox's Book of Martyrs, and I read about the Christians who were tortured in communist prisons and in Nazi prison camps, things. I mean, I read those things when I was a teenager, so I was aware that Christianity involved suffering. I knew the Bible said that too. So I felt that the sufferings I went through, though they were difficult for me, I thought they were relatively minor compared to what Christians historically had to go through in many cases. So, I mean, it never was like, hey, why is this happening to me? I've often had to wonder, why is only this happening to me when so many other Christians have been martyred and tortured and been faithful unto death in real trials. In America, we've got little trials, but they feel big to us because we're living in a rather pampered society, pampered age, prosperous, you know, age.
Correct.
Since World War II, America has been the only world superpower and has been the most prosperous nation.
Yes.
And most peaceful nation, that is living peaceably in our own country, of any nation in history. You know, there's never been anyone as comfortable as we are, as wealthy as we are, with as many conveniences we have. And so even when we go through the kind of trials that are ordinary, kind of run-of-the-mill garden variety trials, we feel like it's a crisis. I mean, losing a loved one. Well, people lose loved ones. Everyone loses loved ones eventually. But, I mean, some people saw their parents hacked to pieces by, you know, invaders and things like that. I mean, this is pretty traumatic stuff, I think.
And that's happening in the world right now.
It is. It is. So, I mean, I've always kept that in perspective. So, you know, when I've gone through the times that are really trying for me personally, that's an emotional, difficult time. But my walk with God has never been based on emotions at all. I mean, I'm kind of more of some people think a little too much of the Vulcan, too much cerebral and not enough emotional. But I feel all the emotions that a person should feel those times. It's just that I've never taken the position that emotions are what we live by, you know?
Hmm.
We certainly don't decide our morality or our life choices or you know, philosophy or what's ultimately true about God. We don't decide those on the way we feel at any given time. I mean, people do. People do that all the time. Lots of Christians are up and down all the time because of emotional changes. But to me, I see the emotional life as the shallowest part of the human life. You know, your intellectual life, your convictions, your character, are actually things that don't change as rapidly as emotions do. Emotions can be manipulated by the slightest things, fluctuations, and you can change your emotions about 10 times a day, whereas your convictions don't change that frequently. I mean, I live my life from my convictions, from what I know is true, and I endure the emotional slings and arrows and so forth when they come. But I have to say, despite the fact I've had some reasonably intense trials, I personally feel like my life's been pretty charmed. You know, I mean, just like everybody in this country.
Because you choose to see that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a comparative thing. You know, I mean, compared to most people on the world, in the world in history, my life has been capable.
Extravagantly bountiful.
Amen.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an extremely interesting perspective on emotions. I basically reached out to you on Facebook Messenger and you agreed to have a conversation, which, by the way, I really appreciate that. I know that you have a certain amount of hours in the day with which to schedule everything you want to do. But my podcast is called Emotion Art. And basically, I agree with everything you're saying about emotions. And the conclusion to me is that emotions are what we create with. Emotions to me are the most important part. And like in everything that you're saying, what I'm curious about is how does that feel to you? What does it look like? Like what is like the world that we create around us is created out of the emotions that we feel. Words are just symbols to hang emotions on, but the actual, what we see, the picture of the thing we're looking at, the overall impression of it is just a collection of emotions. Or I mean, anyway, that's the way it looks to me. So that was just really, really interesting to hear your take
on
that.
Well, you know, I agree with you. Probably most art, at least if we're thinking of music and fine arts, arises from the realm of the emotions, you know. And I have some involvement there too. I'm a published cartoonist. I've drawn dozens of comic books in my youth. That are published or have been, a couple of them still are, most of them are out of print now. So I've had some involvement in art. I'm a musician. I play two instruments and sing and was in several bands. So, I mean, it's not like I'm aloof from the arts, but I don't think that the arts alone are the only way that creativity is expressed. I think that we need to have a vision. For example, I mean, we can build other people's lives just as we can create works of art. We can envision what we hope, for example, our children may be, what kind of build character in them and so forth. We are creators by nature. We're human. I believe we're made in the image of God and he's a creator. And I think creativity is part of our image of God, is that we have creativity as other animals do not. But, I mean, God's creativity isn't all analogous to our fine arts. I mean, certainly the creation of animals and plants and the universe is very artistic, very beautiful. And I'm sure that it came from God's emotions as well as his rational plans. But in addition to being emotional, and I, like I was saying, I don't discount the emotions. I think they are genuine and valuable part of life. And as you just said, probably the place from which much artistic creativity originates. But we are also rational beings, which the other animals are not. And I think God is rational. I think that's part of it, too. I think he's both rational and emotional, just like we are. But the Bible talks about God getting angry. The Bible talks about God being happy, about God being sad. But it also talks about him restraining his emotions for a period of time. You know, like he was angry at man before the time of Noah. And so he decided he's going to restrain his emotions only 120 more years. Before he sends a flood, you know, I mean, 120 years may not be long for him, but it's at least not exactly flying off the handle or having a short fuse. I mean, God restrains emotions and he expresses emotions. But his decision to restrain them or express them, I believe, is governed by his overall rational decisions. And I think, I mean, when we talk about emotions, we're talking about a broad range of things, you know, joy, love, grief, anger, fear.
Curiosity.
There's all kinds of stuff like that. Yeah. And obviously some of those, all of those emotions have generated songs, have generated art. So I don't doubt that. But I haven't lived my life subject to my emotions primarily. I mean, obviously, I value emotions, especially ones that are enjoyable, but I actually value grief too. I've learned a lot and grown a lot through grief. I feel that the emotions have their place and are good, but they also are probably the source of many of our crimes, especially anger, hatred, things like that. Those are emotions too. But so we have emotions that in one setting can be good. I think hatred of evil is a good thing. I think fear of danger is a God-given instinct. I think anger toward injustice and oppression is a righteous thing. Those are all emotions, and they are good insofar as they're appropriate. But of course, all of those things can be out of their proper control.
And the problem with all of them is that what is any one of those? It's all subject to the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
What is
obviously
good?
Only the subjective person is experiencing the emotions he or she is experiencing.
And that's kind of like everything, including character, including all of the things that feel like they're not emotion-based, from what I heard you say, those things are all still built of emotions. Everything starts off with curiosity, because no creation happens until there's curiosity. And then layer by layer, we build through just emotional sensations, stacks and groups of emotional sensations. We build these forms and structures of the base world around us so that we start then hanging the structure of the social interactions and all of the other stuff that we learn and about money and stuff. But at its root, everything is just emotional stories that are layered on each other. What do you think of that?
Well, I suppose even our rational and moral choices are not devoid of emotional aspects.
Like based in emotion, they are built of emotion.
I mean, for example, the decision I made to stay faithful to my wife when she was cheating on me, my first wife.
Mm.
My emotions would have had me do something else than that.
Mm.
But on the other hand, I have convictions. I have convictions about integrity. I have convictions about justice. I have convictions about faithfulness. And those things being so, I can't say there's no emotion involved in those. Obviously, how do you think about justice without being emotional about injustice?
How do you have a thought without emotion?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know how to answer that because I don't know where...
I'm oversimplifying.
I think a lot of emotions come from nerves and from viscera that aren't thought-based. But then, of course, there's emotions in our thoughts too. So, I mean, this is a realm that I don't know if I have enough information to delve.
And it's a rabbit trail. Yeah, I was just curious about it just because you just had an interesting explanation of your perspective of emotions and how transitory and ephemeral they are.
Yeah.
And the important things are not the emotion. So you kind of endure the emotion to get through to the character and the things that are important and the things that you maintain daily. But you were also talking about God and kind of your faith in God and it sounded like you were saying it's been a steady point for you throughout your whole life. You've never really walked away from that stuff. And the first question in my mind is like, in your perspective, what is God? Like, what are you talking about? Can you break that down? And that could be a rabbit trail too, but that's what I'm super curious about. What does that look like to you?
Yeah. Well, my view of God, because I'm a Christian, comes from the Christian texts. I will say many things about traditional Christian views of God are not significant parts of my belief. Whether God is omniscient and knows the future or not, Christians sometimes disagree with each other on that. That's
all the times.
Yeah, that's a nonsense.
About everything.
Yeah, lots of things are discrete among Christians. What I can say, you say, what do I mean by God? I'm thinking of the God who created everything, that he is a personal being as opposed to an impersonal force. And by personal, I mean he has the characteristics of personhood, like intellect, like emotion, like volition, a will, that he's like, we were made in his image, whereas the animals are not. So that why the things that make us different from the animals are things like rational intellect, planning, stuff and free choice between options based on moral or ethical considerations. I don't think animals make those choices. Those things that are in us that are unlike other. See, we got a lot about us that's very much like animals. We've got animal bodies and so forth. But
We're made of the same organic materials.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, we're very much like animals in that respect. But there are things about us that are unlike other animals. And those things are the ones I think are a reflection of God's own nature. Those are what we call the image of God in man. Now, that being so.
Consciousness.
Well,
animals
are conscious.
But like self-consciousness. Or no, okay, then what do you mean?
Okay, no, you may be right. I mean, it is possible that self-consciousness is only a human.
Okay.
I mean, you know, animals feel pain, but do they know they're feeling pain? Is it just a sensation or is it something they're thinking, wow, I'm hurting right now? You know, do they think about it?
Mm.
We don't know. We don't know what's in their heads.
Now we're firmly in philosophy.
Yeah. So I guess my assumption is animals probably don't have much of what we call self-consciousness. But anyway, when I talk about God, I'm talking about a non-physical being who is not part of nature, and therefore he's supernatural. He's invisible unless he chooses not to be. He's a spirit, Jesus said. Jesus said God is a spirit. And that means, you know, he's not like the gods on Mount Olympus that were more like human beings, like superhumans. He's more like something beyond the natural world, who is the creator and sustainer of the natural world. So that's what I mean by God.
But you wouldn't see God as being part of the natural world or part of everything. It's a complete, there's a completely separate entity, and in no way is I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, because I'm imagining this being and I'm like saying, okay, is it in a world of being? So where did this being come from? And I know that these are silly questions that people chase around, but I'm actually trying to see it. Like, how does it look to you? Is it just like God, like there's like has to be a magic spell before it? Or is there like, how does that make sense in your mind?
There are things that are beyond all of our pay grade. You know, we really have to say, even if you think in terms of infinity.
I love to think in terms of that.
Even the infinity of a series of numbers. There's no highest number. You can always add another one. And, you know, the whole thing makes your brain hurt to think about it. Infinity of space.
Unless you think of it like a circle.
Well, but I don't think the numbers go in a circle. I think they keep going the direction of adding another one moves further away from the beginning number. Now, the universe may go in a circle. I don't really know much about that. Einstein's theories are, again, above my pay grade. But
and there's more since him.
Yes. But I think that what we have to deal with is that everything came from something, and that something had to be first. Now, that first, there's two options, as far as I know, that anyone has ever proposed. One is what was here first was matter and energy. And that matter and energy are simply brute facts of existence. You know, matter and energy have always existed, and that's all there is to it. Everything came from that, from a Big Bang or whatever. You know, the matter acting, you know, in obedience to natural laws, or wherever they came from, with energy combining matter certain ways, created the universe and everything eventually in it. But the whole thing is that you had to have matter and energy at the beginning. And whereas the other option is what you had was not matter and energy, but something beyond the realm of matter and energy, something supernatural. And given the fact that the laws of cause and effect and even common sense would suggest to us that nothing could have come about unless the cause of it was adequate to produce it, then we'd have to say, since many of the effects that have come into existence in the universe include living things, conscious things, intelligent things, spiritual things, beings, that matter and energy doesn't seem to have the potential to produce those things. At least if it does, science has never confirmed that it does. It's never been able to prove that any living thing ever arose from a non-living source, for example.
It sure is a leap of the imagination, I can tell you that.
It is. And
whew.
The other option is that the first cause was a living thing and was creative and was intelligent and did have a plan and things like that. So that's a God idea as opposed to naturalistic idea. So, I mean, where did God come from? That is a puzzling question. I mean, there is no answer provided. If we say, well, God always existed forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever, and again, it makes your brain hurt to even think of anything exist in forever and ever. Although to say that God is the brute fact of the universe that always existed, something did, is not any more problematic in that sense than saying matter and energy are brute facts that always existed. The fact that anything always existed is bizarre. That it would be something personal and not part of the natural realm.
Do we have a responsibility to understand it?
I don't think I do. I try not to worry myself about things that I realize the answer is beyond the horizon of sight and horizon even up of perception. So, I mean, not that I can't theorize, but there are some things that even too vast even to theorize about. Where did eternity come from?
Sure.
Who knows?
So what is it? What feels important to you? Like, what is big on your mind then?
Well, what's big on my mind is purpose. What is the purpose? Because if you've got, these are the two possibilities. Everything came from matter and energy, which means matter and energy having no mind itself has no purpose and therefore did not design. Everything is the way it is, certainly by fortunate accidents, but they could have been any other way, and being this way is no more fulfilling of any purpose than any other. And this is the naturalistic view that the universe doesn't really have a purpose. We can imagine purposes. We can adopt for ourselves a purpose for living. You know, we can adopt meaning for ourselves, but that's entirely subjective. It doesn't mean it can be said to be the reason the universe exists or the reason anyone else exists. I can say, well, I exist to serve humanity, or I exist to make the world a better place. Okay, well, that's my purpose. I adopt it, but I can't really say that's a transcendent purpose that I can impose on everything, because there is no ultimate purpose. The matter and energy of the universe never had a purpose. It's not conscious. It's not purposeful. And therefore, it didn't design anything. Now, the other worldview, the idea that there is some kind of a God out there, supernatural being who has those powers, we can't know. We can't say for sure just because we believe there's such a being that he has a purpose. But we can say, if everything is created by an intelligent being, there's a good reason to think there could be a purpose, and it might be possible that that divine being would reveal that to us. That's, of course, the implications of belief in God, that there is some transcendent purpose that can be discovered or revealed. I'm not sure how it would be discovered without it being revealed, but the Christian worldview is, of course, that God has revealed himself. He's revealed himself to the first human beings. He revealed himself various ways throughout history, eventually to the Jewish people through the prophets who were, you know, inspired by God to speak for him and reveal what he wants from people. And essentially what he wanted from people is just the kind of thing that we could wish that a divine being would want, and he wants people to be just, to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly. I mean, those are the kind of things that sure would be a better place in the world would be if everyone did justice and walk humbly and love mercy. I mean, it's just the kind of values that a being actually superior to us, but actually having concerns very much like our own, would have. In fact, it's hard to believe if there's no God and he has no concern with these things, why we would even have a concept of justice. If we're living in a naturalistic world with no purposeful creation, and we're the product of natural selection only, acting upon random mutations and so forth, which brought about eventually variations within a species, eventually crossing a boundary into a new species, eventually we're here. If that's really what happened, there's no really reason to believe that justice is a factor in reality at all, because survival of the fittest isn't survival of the best or the nicest or the most worthy. Survival of the fittest involves all kinds of brutality and predatory activity on innocent prey and things like that. I mean, that's how the animal world works. And if we simply were the most highly evolved animal, where's this whole idea of justice come from? We might say, well, we've learned as intelligent beings that society is a nicer place to live in if people treat each other well and imagine that they have rights that you don't want to violate and so forth, and you want to be kind. It'd be a better world if everyone did that. True, that is, to be more comfortable. But to say that there's some kind of transcendent value that insists upon this, is a very different kind of statement. To say that there's a God who made us to live according to justice and mercy and faithfulness, as Jesus said, the weightier matters of the law are. If there's a God who did that, then that makes sense that this would be a reality. Justice is a real thing. Mercy is a real thing. Love is a real thing. But if there is no such being, then nature has generated everything, including the operation of our brains. And our thinking is nothing more than the natural laws working on the neurons of our brain, causing them to fire off certain ways and resulting in certain thoughts, opinions, emotions, convictions. And really, if that's true, then we don't really have free choice at all. And strict naturalists believe that we don't have free will, because every thought we have, which we imagine to be a free choice, is really just the way that the natural laws worked on the particular electronics and chemistry of our brain in our head, generating these thoughts. There's not some soul in us deciding to think certain things. It's just thoughts occur to us just like indigestion occurs to us. It's just a physical thing on an organ of our body. We, of course, have the sense that our thoughts are connected to some reality, but it's strictly an illusion if, in fact, our thoughts are, let's say my thoughts are different than a Buddhist thoughts, different from a Hindu's thoughts, different than an atheist thoughts, so forth. I mean, my thoughts about things are different. If naturalism is true, there's no particular thoughts that are superior to any others. They're all equally good because they're not really based on any, thoughts are not connected to reality. They're connected to the movement of atoms in the brain, mirror. And there's no agency. We have no agency in what we choose or anything like that. We're just like animals, really. There's nothing more to us than that. We're just more highly evolved. But in my mind, that's not the case. In my mind, we do have a non-material functioning of our soul that acts upon the brain. And I mean, even scientists who don't believe in God have used the analogy of the brain being like a machine that can be operated by a ghost. John Eccles, who has received the Nobel Prize for his work on the brain, said that, and it's been repeated.
And now with all the quantum research, it's becoming weirder and weirder and weirder.
Things are very weird, yeah. But again, philosophically, if there is no me other than the machine, if I'm just an elaborate robot working on programmed circuitry and not designed for anything, but happened to be fortunate enough to be able to move and think and do things, my thoughts are just generated from random natural impact on my neurons. There's really philosophically no reason to believe that my thoughts are any more trustworthy than someone else's. Which means, of course, that if I were a total naturalist and didn't believe in the supernatural and didn't believe in the soul and just believe the brain's a machine that no ghost is running, then it's not run by anything. It's not run by me. It's not run by anything. It's just doing things. And then if I were a naturalist, I'd have to say, therefore, my very naturalism doesn't have any intrinsic validity either, because it's just the way my neurons are firing to make me think this way, that there's no supernatural. So, I mean, we get into the weeds pretty deep.
And the crazy thing about that is I listen to both options, and both options sound absolutely 100% correct to me, with no contradictions between them. The world that I see, I've been trying to coalesce what my concept of God is, and the best I can do is that I'm looking at what God would look like in this place in time and space when I look at you. As I'm speaking to you, you are what, in this moment of time and space, this is what God would think. This is how God would trim its beard. Like, that's kind of the best nutshell I've gotten for how I kind of perceive God. But I also look at all systems are patterns, repeating patterns, smaller and larger. No matter what you look at or which way you go, you're going to see repeating patterns. And so to kind of oversimplify it, all of the star systems and stuff are basically neurons in a bigger structure. And who am I to say what consciousness is? Like, why is the plant that responds to the seasons, the flytrap eats bugs, like, why is the plant any less conscious than me just because it's differently conscious? And so to me, the summation of the consciousness that overlies everything would be the consciousness of God. And I'm just trying to put all my cards on the table. Like, this is the perspective I'm coming from. The best I can figure it out. I'm still trying to figure it out for a frame of reference. Yes.
Well, you know, being raised in the 60s and 70s and coming of age during the hippie movement, I have to say, I was exposed to an awful lot of New Age thinking, which is what the hippies enjoyed.
Yes.
And people get really deep into questions of, you know, maybe we don't even exist. Maybe we're a dream of God.
Yeah.
More recent generations have talked about the matrix. You know, maybe this is really just a matrix. Yes. We're not even in a real world. Mm-hmm. I think that if we use our imaginations, we can come up with an endless number of scenarios of what may possibly be true.
And we do.
But every day we live our lives as if reality is a certain way, as if physical things before us are physical, as if things we say to people affect them for better or for ill, if certain things we do are right and other things are wrong. I mean, we live our lives that way. And we would do so even if we had adopted some really far-fetched ideas about what the ultimate of reality is. My own thought is, I can only work with the data that I can perceive and that I can reason from. If I reach the most rational, reasonable synthesis of the data that I'm aware of, I'm doing the most I can do. If there's a different reality, this isn't reality and so forth, well, it's the only reality I have to work with. So that's what
you're doing the best you can with what you actually have.
Right. And I don't have any fears that this is a mistake to do.
Or that it's a trick. You're on a game show and the trap door is going to fall open at any point.
The Truman.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah. No, I don't feel that way. And I'll tell you why. Because I was raised a Christian, but when I was about 12 or so, like most kids raised in Christian homes, I had to ask myself, why am I a Christian? Why do I believe these things? I mean, my parents do, but Mormon kids believe what their parents believe, and Muslim kids believe what their parents believe. The fact that my parents believe something isn't a self-validating way of accepting things. So I began to ask myself those questions, and I was interested. I was a little more on the philosophical side probably than many 12-year-olds are, but
I was going to say, 12 feels like an average age for you to start that?
Let me tell you something.
I was 30.
This literally happened. This happened when I was 7.
Okay.
I was in my second grade class in grammar school, and our teacher showed a film strip of how the world was came into being. And it was the typical idea that the sun was a flaming ball of gases, and it was spinning, and it spun off different flaming balls of gases that cooled off. They were far enough away to stay away from the being pulled back by the sun's gravity, but close enough to be held in an orbit. From that distance, they cooled off and became solid objects and became planets and so forth. You don't know what a film strip is. This is before they had video. This is before they had any kind of technology like that, but we just had these little strips of film that they'd run manually through a camera. It'd be a picture and there'd be a phonograph record made of vinyl playing the narration, and it would go ding when you're supposed to change the slide. That's the way we had audio visual when I was a kid.
But it's like a slideshow for video.
It is. But so anyway, the thing is that I was watching that, and I had no reason to be skeptical of what my teacher was telling me. I was only 7. But at recess, I walked around the playground, around the fence. The other kids were playing. I was walking around the playground thinking about this. And when I came back to class, I said to my teacher, you know, Miss Burke, I believe that film strip was wrong. And she said, really? What do you think was wrong about it? And I said, well, it said that the earth came from the sun. But the Bible says that God created the heavens and the earth first, and then he made the sun. And she said, oh, I guess they forgot. You know, I guess they forgot about that. And she didn't debate me or anything. I was a kid. But I mean, I had those thoughts. I used my whole recess time to walk around the perimeter of the field to think that through and think, what is not right about that? And I remember when I was not much older than that, maybe 10 years old, you know, out mowing the lawn or something and looking at the grass and thinking, what must it be like to be grass? What if the atoms of my body had not been a human body? What if they'd been a tree? What would it be like? You know, I mean, I was always thinking that way. And
do you still think that way?
Not.
When did you stop thinking that way?
Well, I put away that particular thinking, realizing that it probably isn't like anything. What's it like to be a tree? Probably isn't like anything. As far as I know, a tree doesn't have a nervous system or a cerebral apparatus to even contemplate such things.
But Steve, do you remember how fun it was to imagine it? The purpose of imagining what it's like to be a tree is the same as the purpose of life, because that's what we're here for.
You know,
I don't know.
That's the question. What are we here for? You know, and those are the kind of things I thought about too.
Well, that's where we started this whole rabbit trail, and you said this is about purpose, and then you mostly talked, I think, about morality.
Right, because morality is joined at the hip to purpose.
Why?
Because morality is the category of thought that says this thing should be done and this thing should not be done. That's what morality is. Morality is the realm of should and should not. It's not the realm of is and is not.
As decided by who is the problem.
Well, I know. But the point is, if we believe there is such thing as morality, it is joined to the idea of purpose. The reason that some things should not be done is because they go against the purposes of existence, and other things should not
be done. So you're saying that morality...
agreeable with the purpose of existence.
So you're saying that morality then is... I'm extrapolating. Morality is the purpose of existence?
No, morality is living in accordance with the purpose of existence.
Oh.
In my mind, there is a purpose, and morality defines what it means to live consistently with that purpose.
Okay.
The purpose is not just that I live morally. The purpose is a higher thing than that. It is that I connect with the Creator, that I connect with Him in a positive sense as opposed to a negative sense, that the Creator, being a personal entity, has things that He approves of and things He doesn't approve of. And those are the basis of morality. And why does He disapprove of them? Because they are in violation of the purpose that He made us for.
Is your connection with God, again, morality? Like you're saying, connect with God on a positive. That's good. That's moral. Connect with God on a negative. That's immoral. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, when I talk about morality, I'm talking about the imposition of moral mandates on human life. You know, it doesn't relate to animal life, doesn't relate to plant life.
But that always takes a human to do that. No human has an imposition of anything outside of another human putting it on themselves, unless you're just talking about the impositions we put on our own selves.
What I mean is it requires at least a human, not less than a human.
Oh, you know, you're not, gotcha.
Yeah.
You have to be human in order for it to apply.
Right. Well, okay. Animals are lower than men. Plants are lower than men, and they don't apparently have any interest in morality or any thoughts of morality. We believe they're amoral. We don't believe humans are amoral. So in the realm of created things, humans may be the lowest level of moral beings, angels perhaps above us also being moral beings, God Himself the ultimate moral being. The point being that there is such a thing as right and wrong. And humans are the only physical creations that we know of. There may be some on other planets that we don't know about. I have no idea. But the only created beings we know of that are physical, that have any sense of morality, are humans. So morality requires at least human, if not more than human, abilities and obligations.
And it sounds like morality is a hierarchy too, because if the only thing that I can hear that is basing your levels of higher and lower, where you talk about humans being in the middle, angels, plants, animals, the hierarchy is what is your level of capacity for morality. And I'm still feel like I'm hearing that the purpose for existence feels like it is morality in what you're saying. And I think that I don't know that I'm hearing that correctly, but...
You know, I mean, it depends. Morality, referring to the whole realm of what is right and what is wrong. I believe that having a connection with God is a right thing to do, and to neglect that is a wrong thing to do. So maybe that's the ultimate moral choice, when we talk about morality in general, we're usually talking about how we interact with other human beings. To say it is wrong to murder,
yeah,
is wrong with adultery, it's wrong to steal from somebody, it's wrong to lie about somebody.
Which there are always exceptions to all of those rules. I mean, unless you're an extreme situation, like a pacifist, maybe wouldn't have an exception to the murder is wrong, but everybody else is going to.
Well, the thing about murder is that people assume that killing a human being always falls into the category of murder. In the Christian worldview, it does not. God indicates that some things that people do make them worthy of death. That is, there are capital crimes. Now, it's not my place to go out and decide if somebody has committed a capital crime and killed them. That's not my role. But the Bible indicates that God has established societies and governments to enforce the rights of innocent people. And the killing of an innocent person is certainly murder. Now, the killing of somebody who has done something worthy of death is not murder. It's still killing, but it's not murder. It's justice. I mean, if someone deserves something and you give them what they deserve, that's the very nature of what justice is. If they don't deserve something and you give it to them anyway, something bad, that's injustice. The point is that the Christian believes, or I believe because of this, that God has moral standards based on his own nature. Now, there's an old atheistic challenge that's often brought up, and I've debated atheists publicly and had to face this many times, which isn't a problem to me, but they bring up
you
the
love
question,
debating.
I do, actually.
Yes.
I actually
I am so glad that you know and appreciate that about yourself.
Oh, yeah. I don't have any problem debating at all.
Fantastic.
I consider it educational. I don't see it as an opportunity to make the other person look bad or to win.
It's not
I
a competition.
No, it's not. It's an education.
Perfect.
But when atheists love to ask this question, if we say God is good, is it because there's a standard of good and evil that stands above him to which he conforms so that he's not good in himself except in that he follows some kind of a standard that he's subject to of morality?
Good as compared to what?
Or alternatively, is everything he says good just because he says it? In which case, to say God is good is just say God is what he is. And he could as easily say killing babies is a good plan for everybody to do.
And it does. The Old Testament does have those texts.
There are there's one instance. Yeah, there's one
and
instance.
I'm not trying to bring that up. I'm just saying. I don't know. Why did I say it then? Okay, go ahead.
Well, the point is, the Christian view is that God is who he is. And that morality is based on who he is.
Yeah,
he is a being who's passionate for justice,
yeah,
who's merciful, who's faithful. These are character traits that he wants us to emulate. And for us, what is immoral is when we're not being just, when we're not being faithful, when we're not being compassionate. Those are unjust or immoral things. When we are doing what is just, what is merciful, and what is compassionate, and what is faithful and following truth and integrity, we're being like God in that respect. He's the standard, and those are therefore morally good things. If he had been a bad God, an evil God, well, I mean, that'd be a terrible thing because we couldn't change it. We couldn't do anything to change him. But fortunately, he's a God who is, those things. Now, we call those things good, and we could say we call those good because God commands them. Yeah, well, why does he command them? He commands them because they conform to a standard, which is himself, his own character. I mean, if God had been devilish instead of like he is, the world and the universe would be a place where, everybody's in the position of flies that little boys like to pull wings off of. It'd just be torture. Yeah. A bad God could have his wicked delight in our torture, but he isn't that way.
Well, that kind of reminds me of my conversation with John Maher, basically kind of from Alan Watts, from some of those speakers from the 70s. I got the concept of the joyful universe and the optimistic universe. And that's when if someone wants to know like what philosophical box I put myself in, that's what I am. I am somebody who sees an optimistic universe, a joyful universe. And John Maher's like, the fact that you can see an optimistic universe means that the universe is optimistic. It's like the fingerprint of God, that that's who God is. And it just feels like the inverse of what you're saying.
What I would say is that there is purpose in our being. And things that are consistent with that purpose are moral. And things that are inconsistent with that purpose are immoral. And the purpose is to be like God, to be imitators of God, to have a character that is like his.
Who is unknowable. Be like someone unknowable. That sounds easy. Let's go.
I don't believe he's unknowable.
No.
I don't believe God's I think he's undiscoverable. But I don't think he's unknowable, because any being in God's position can make himself known. He can reveal himself. And that's what I believe he has done.
And so, okay, not to do the whole, well, everyone's God is real to them, but in your words, if God is not discoverable, which means you can't go out with a pickaxe and a shovel and find God, but God will reveal God's self, himself, however, whatever, God will reveal himself to anyone he wants to, in the right conditions, in whatever. So who's to say that the Hindu, the Muslim, the Buddhist, the everybody who is sincere, because in your story, you know, where you, when you were 11 and you're like, well, why do I have the right, you know, why do I see it the right way? Why is it this? What if it's this other way? I mean, talking to Jehovah's Witness and LDS made me realize that these are young people like me who have come to where they are through sincere, like they are all in for being everything they can be. And they're so honest and sincere. And so I'm just like, wait a minute, we're both feeling the same thing. And we've come to completely different conclusions that this is not either God's a sadist or something isn't the way we think it is. And so eventually over the decades, I finally come to a point where I'm like, oh, we're all looking at the same thing. We just see it from a different set of experiences and emotions. And so it looks different to us. So it's different sides of the coin. But how do you know if God's revealing it himself to you, if it's all happening in the spirit world? It's not a three-dimensionally physical thing you can grasp and you can touch. It's not objectively verifiable and testable. And the entire human condition is we're trying to figure out what's going on. The God that I have come to know isn't a confusing person that lives in the dark and like does little hand tricks and shadows to try to like, what if it is all so much more simple than any one of us thinks, and we are all looking at the same thing, and God really is just this being of love who just, like, everything is actually one, and we're all fighting because we believe that it's separate, that it's black and white, that it's yes and no, that it's this and that, when really, it's not nihilism. It's not, it doesn't feel like that inside me. And so that's why I'm like, these are the things that are in my mind that are just begging to be looked at and explored.
My understanding of God and the way he is not in itself trying to cast aspersions on somebody else's ideas about God. I mean,
yes.
One time medical science thought that, you know, putting leeches on people would get bad juices out of them and get well.
Yeah.
They were sincere.
Yes.
They were sincere, but they had not discovered what we now know more about medical science. So, I mean, I'm not here to put down sincere people. I'm here to say some people are not up to speed with what has already become known in some circles. And what the Bible indicates is that God did reveal himself in certain circles, particularly among the Jewish people.
Lucky them.
Well, yeah, amen, lucky them and lucky
Except
us.
Except that, because I mean, here they go again, getting, you know, it's just like...
Let me finish my thought.
Okay,
let me finish
my thought. Okay.
In the time of Abraham, all nations worshipped statues made of stone and wood, which were monstrous, which required them to sacrifice their children and things like that.
Kind of animism.
It was a development from animism, right? Okay. Animism is the idea that there is a spirit in all the stones and the trees and everything. This was a development from that, which we call, actually above that is pantheism, and then above that is polytheism. And polytheism is that there are many gods, and they connect with us through these statues and so forth. And there's Christians who understand Christianity that way too. Unfortunately, I don't think it's correct. But the point is, Abraham was uniquely, he received a revelation from God. We don't know exactly what form that took, but God told him to do something, leave your family, go to this country, and I'm going to use you and your offspring to bless all the nations of the world. Now, the ultimate fulfillment of this, we see, was in Christ coming from the seed of Abraham, that God used the Jewish people to bring Christ into the world. Were they a good tool? Well, they're entirely human, full of all the flaws that all humans have. That mm-hmm. God never indicated better people. He never even said that they had unconditional blessings available to them, because he said, if you keep my commandments, I'll bless you. If you don't, I won't. So they were just as subject as any pagans to, you know, God's disapproval, but they did receive information about what God desires for them. And that's something that not all had had. But he did intend for them to take that information and give it to the world. That's what he says. He intended for them to be a light to the nations, the Gentiles. So in choosing Israel, God wasn't choosing people for some kind of unconditional privilege. It actually put a great responsibility on them, and they had an assignment. And if they didn't fulfill it, they could suffer God's disapproval as much as anyone else. Their assignment was to bring the knowledge of God to the whole world, for all of us. Toward that end, the Jewish people received periodically prophets from God who spoke what God's word was. Moses being probably the chief one and the founder of their religious system. He was the great prophet. There were many prophets after him that essentially confirmed what he said and developed it, until actually they began to be told through these prophets that a Messiah would come, and he would be the seed of Abraham, through whom all the nations would be blessed that God had promised Abraham. And then Jesus came and seemed to be fulfilling all the prophecies about the Messiah. And I believe he did and was. So we have then a God who revealed himself to a group of people with giving them the assignment to pass on that revelation to others. Now, you mentioned how could God reveal himself? Since this is all very spiritual and nebulous and so forth, I don't think his revelation to Israel is very nebulous at all. He sometimes appeared rather visibly, parting the Red Sea and leading them in a pillar of cloud and things like that, giving them the law and then revelations from the prophets whose credentials had to be very strictly made. If they predicted anything would happen, it had to happen. If it didn't happen, they were false prophets. And there were false prophets as well as real ones. It was the writings of the real ones who met that credential that were preserved in what we usually call the Old Testament, the Jews call the Tanakh. But then Jesus came as the fulfillment of those. And his resurrection from the dead particularly demonstrated that he is not like others. He was exactly who he claimed to be. He predicted he'd rise from the dead on the third day, and he did. And his disciples witnessed it, and so did some others. And so he fulfilled these prophecies, and now his message to the world is the blessing that the Abrahamic people were to provide for all the nations. And that's why the disciples of Jesus went to all the nations, to bring that revelation to them. Now, God has revealed himself through Jesus, and that's not nebulous. That was a historical character, flesh and blood, who lived and worked the miracles of God and so forth and rose from the dead in front of thousands of witnesses, actually. So it's not like there's some kind of vague and nebulous sense in which God reveals himself. Now, I will say this. Ever since Jesus came, the Bible says that he gave his Holy Spirit to his disciples. And so his disciples do have the Spirit of Christ, and he does in various ways reveal his will to them through the Spirit. That is more nebulous. That is more subjective. But the kind of God he is not based on Christians' special feelings and subjective revelations they think they receive. It's based on Jesus himself, who is in no sense nebulous or non-physical, and his teachings. So we have a revelation of the existence of God, the nature of God, and the will of God in Jesus himself. Now, of course, one can argue that Jesus wasn't God, and that's their business, or that he wasn't Son of God, or he didn't speak for God. Anyone can do what they want with the evidence. However, most people don't ever look at the evidence. They just have a visceral response, an emotional response, perhaps, rather than a rational one. But when one looks at the evidence out there, in my opinion, a rational person will say, well, there's no one else out there who makes as well-established a claim to speak for the real God than he did. And therefore, becoming his follower is what I understand to be the purpose of human existence. And so that's why I'm a follower of his.
Oh, it just strikes me. And I mean, it's interesting coming full circle from having been really in a perspective, gone through the teachings of John Mark, the Jim Roberts group, raised in the Jim Roberts group, Amish perspective and theology, Stan Avery, you know, the home churches, all the different iterations of it. And then to come here where it's like, I've come to a point where I see the world differently now. And as I listened to all that, I was like, there's no way I would be able to make heads or tails of it. It's so complicated and confusing. The reaction inside me is one of being like, I can't follow that. It's so complicated of genealogies, and I wouldn't be able to come to it unless I sat and listened to your teachings about it, or somebody who saw the world the same way as you. And that's always been the confusing part for me. Why would God, who loves me more than I love my children, why, like, how could it possibly be this confusing? And that's just my perspective. Like, I know from your perspective, that feels simple. It feels simple. And I believe that it's simple, and it makes sense that it's simple to you. But to somebody who hasn't steeped in it, who doesn't understand the world the way you do, it's going to feel impossibly complicated. All of the Tanakh, yeah, all going into the Torah, into the law and the history and all of the explanations of why it makes sense that we're a follower of Christ. It just feels,
you know, very,
yeah,
very simple-minded people can read the Bible and get the basic message, which is there's a God who made us, who cares for us, against whom we've rebelled, and he has set about to redeem us back to himself. Those are simple concepts, just like a man might do with his children.
Sure.
Then it's the fact that the Bible indicates that God has chosen to reveal himself to people, and that's largely through the prophets in the Old Testament, and then more fully through Jesus at a later date, who is a historical character and who spoke in words people could hear with their natural ears and not have to hear through mysterious revelations. Mm. So, I mean, this is, to me, it's a rather simple thing. The idea of God to the Jew is much simpler than that of Hinduism. I mean, Hinduism has millions of gods. You know, Buddhism doesn't even necessarily have a god.
Yeah, but Hinduism has millions of gods, and Judaism has millions of interpretations of text.
Well, there.
Okay. I'm not talking about Christianity. I'm talking about like Judaism, like the Kabbalah and like the Talmud. You start getting into like deep Judaism, right, and they're not layers of gods, but there sure are layers. Sorry, distraction.
Yeah, my friends who are Jews have actually said they have a saying where there's three views, there's four opinions. Yeah. You know, so yeah. I mean, obviously, Jews have many camps. The thing is, though, when you accept the fact that Jesus has come in fulfillment of the promises and has credentialed himself with miracles and his own resurrection from the dead and so forth, seeing the Old Testament prophets through his lens is exactly the sensible thing to do, since he is who he is. And that's the thing. The New Testament indicates that even the prophets in the Old Testament had trouble understanding a lot of the things that God revealed to them, because they were kind of hazy. They were hazy.
But then wheels Jesus, and wheels, thrones,
yeah, exactly,
and alabaster. What are you talking about? Yeah.
Yeah, but Jesus made it all pretty simple.
Yeah.
He basically said, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbors yourself. This is the whole law and the prophets.
Now I can follow. Simple. I can follow that easily.
That's easy, yeah.
So great, yeah.
I mean, it's not always easy, but it's simple. Yeah. It's not complicated.
No, that's what I mean. It's not complicated.
Yeah. And that's what I believe.
Love is not complicated.
The thing, though, is when we say, I only need to love, we need to understand that there's a lot of different understandings of what love is, because
of course
I might say I might love chocolate ice cream, or I might love my cat or my dog. I might love my children. I might love my wife. I might love my country. I mean, these are all different kinds of loves, and they all kind of look different. I mean, the way I respond to these entities I love. But what the Bible, Jesus makes it real plain. He said, here's what love looks like. As you would that men should do to you, do that to them. This is the whole law and the prophets, which is the same thing he said about love your neighbors yourself. This is the whole law and the prophets. So what does love look like? It's what you do toward others in terms of treating them justly and mercifully.
Love, mercy.
And faithfully. These were the characteristics of God. So,
and walk humbly.
And walk humbly with your God.
Stan Avery always adds, do unto others as you would have them do unto you if you were in their shoes. Like, he's like, that's the part that we're always missing, because one person right. wants, the other person doesn't want. So don't do what you want to them. Yeah. That's not safe.
Right. And also, of course, as you would want them to do to you, knowing what you do about what's good
that's
for
true.
People. I mean, people, for example,
you're only responsible for what you know.
Yeah, if I was a drug addict and I wish people would just hand me more drugs, then for me to treat others as I would want people to treat me would mean for me give them drugs.
Yeah.
But obviously, that's not the idea. It's not
right.
In my most carnal desires and my most unenlightened desires, I want these shallow things. Rather, what I, as a person informed by what's ultimately good for people, what I would want people to do for me, for my highest good, is what I should do for others too.
So basically what I hear you saying is do unto others as you think you should do unto them.
Well, as you think you'd want them to do to you.
But it's the you think part that makes all of the trouble in this world.
Well, I don't have any trouble knowing what I'd like people to do to me. I'd like people to treat me justly.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like people to treat me compassionately. I'd like people to treat me faithfully. And those are the things that Jesus said are the weightier matters of the law.
Yeah.
All the law, what love is. Love is being just, being compassionate, being faithful. That's what love is.
Yeah.
Love may also be accompanied by emotions, as we've been mentioning, but emotions of fondness, emotions of eros, emotions are...
One definition of love is an emotion.
Yeah, well, the point here is that love can be a feeling, but the thing that makes love distinctively God's love is not defined by the feeling. It's defined by the response. So Jesus said, greater love has no man than this, but that he laid down his life for a friend. Now, Jesus laid down his life for us. I don't know how much he felt good about it. I don't know how fond he was of the people who were spitting at him and saying, come down from the cross if you're really who you say you are. But he loved them. He forgave them. He gave his life for them. Giving your life is something you do. It's not something you feel. Frankly, if you feel love too, that makes it all the easier. It's a lot easier to give your life or lay down your life or give up your rights or make sacrifices for someone that you feel fondness toward, because it kind of makes you feel good to do that.
Mm.
But the issue is not making you feel good. The issue is doing what is best for them.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly it's best for them that you don't treat them unjust or you don't lie to them. You're unfaithful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love how we've explored through a few different topics here. And the reason this is also interesting to me is because I had a conversation with my sister, Laurel. She wrote me a letter and she's just like, I'm going to just be honest with you. Like, I have questions. What are you doing? Why did you walk away from God? What about all of this immorality you're living in? And like your whole life has changed. And I was just like, you want to talk about these things instead of we've just been burying them because everyone's afraid. And she's just like, yeah, it's like, come up. So anyway, we had a conversation where we just talked like this. It's just like, I don't know what to do. She doesn't know what to do. And we talked through it. Well, another friend of mine who I've done a interview with, Orlo, he heard that conversation with her and he said, I'm listening to this conversation. I'm saying, why are we sitting here talking about God? And so he wanted to have another conversation titled, Why God Anyway? And actually, I'm about to release that one in a couple of weeks. But the question he wants to know is whether you believe in God or whether you don't believe in God. Why are you spending your time trying to figure out how God works and what our purpose is? And why don't you just, if you believe in God, enjoy God? Just be enjoying God instead of being trying to convince everyone else to enjoy God or figure everything out. And if you don't believe in God, enjoy not God. And his question is, why? I've asked a lot of different people that. And it's still fresh on my mind. What would you say?
Oh, I'd love to answer that. First of all, to me, the issue is not whether I'm enjoying God. When I go through trials and I'm getting beat to a pulp by, life, I'm not enjoying God at that time. But I don't think that the purpose of my existence is to enjoy God or to enjoy anything, because I am not the significant person in the universe. There's no reason why my enjoyment should be made the priority to anybody, including me. I'm just one of millions and billions of people on the planet whose interests are every bit as important as mine. So why should my interests and my enjoyment be a major factor? My concern is not whether I'm enjoying God, but whether he's enjoying me or not.
Mm.
He is the center of the universe. He is the center of all things. And his being pleased is really the purpose of existence. It so happens that when I live a life pleasing to him, it's also, frankly, very gratifying and pleasing to me too, most of the time. But when following him means I have to walk through a meat grinder, that doesn't please me. But it's still, if he's pleased for me to love him enough to go through those things and still be loyal to him, then that's what's important in life. Now, you see, that's the difference between what Jesus taught and what everyone else believed. Everyone believes that you should probably pick the religion that works for you, the religion that makes you satisfied, that makes you happy, the God that you enjoy. Jesus said, if anyone comes after me, he's going to have to deny himself and take up his cross, which nobody enjoys doing, and follow me. Because Jesus did that. Jesus denied himself. He took up a cross. He set an example and gave us a demonstration of what God favors and what pleases God.
Other than carrying a wooden cross, what does it mean to take up the cross?
Well, obviously, that's a figure of speech. The disciples to whom he said that didn't even know at that point that he was going to die on a cross. So they didn't associate it with specifically like we do in retrospect. Retrospect, we think of the cross, Jesus died on the cross. Well, to them, Jesus dying on the cross was not in their frame of reference. They didn't know that was going to happen. But they knew many people died on crosses because the Romans killed lots of people that way. And it was standard practice for the Romans, once they condemned a man to death and intended to crucify him, to make him carry the crossbeam to the place of execution, marching through a crowd, the streets surrounded by hissing and booing and spitting crowds and so forth. This is how condemned men were treated. And so the idea of taking it on a cross and voluntarily carrying it when nobody else is putting it on you.
Mm.
I mean, nope, the cross on my back. For me to bear a cross means that I take on the mentality of one that, life is short. The man who's carrying his cross to his place of execution knew better than most that life is short. Like this was to be maybe a few hours longer. So, I mean, life is short. Eternity is long. Doing what I'm supposed to do may well earn me the disapproval of people. There's certain suffering that goes along with taking the path of following Jesus, since it's a lot like bearing a cross because you're doing so against the tide of human approval. That's a very common theme in the Bible, is that when you follow Christ, you're going against what you would do if you're seeking man's approval. Paul said in Galatians that if I was still seeking to please men, I would not be the servant of Christ. So the idea is you deny your own, what should we say, your own centrality. You know, it's our nature from birth is to put ourselves at the center of all concerns. We manipulate everything around us for us.
Babies are the perfect narcissists.
Yeah, we may not be classic narcissists,
no,
but we are certainly narcissistic.
Yeah.
We're certainly narcissistic in the sense that nothing matters unless it's something that pleases us.
And we're not even aware of something that isn't about us.
Yeah, exactly. We're not mindful of what other people are going through. We're not empathetic. We don't care who we inconvenience as long as it's what we want. Now, that's our nature. And that's what we have to turn from. That's what the word repent actually means in the Bible. To change your mind means you change your mind out. Who's in the middle? Who's in the center? Who does the universe revolve around? And therefore, you as part of the universe are supposed to revolve around that nucleus, that center. And before you come to Christ, you think yourself is the center. And everything is evaluated insofar as it pleases you or does you good. But you change your mind. That's what repent means. When you say, now, wait a minute, I'm not really sure where I got the impression that the universe should revolve around me. Who am I? I'm a speck of dust. It seems to me the universe is to glorify God. And I'm part of the universe, so I'm supposed to do that too. And he's the center. And I'm going to now live not to seek my own pleasure at everybody's expense, but to seek God's pleasure at my own expense. That's what taking up a cross looks like. That's what denying myself. So someone says, well, why don't we just enjoy God and not even worry about who he is? Well, if I was just interested in me, I'd make a God of my own imagination who I really could enjoy. But if the God I enjoy is giving me permission to do wrong to other people, to live immorally and so forth, well, that God isn't the real God. And therefore is not the God I'm going to meet and give an account to someday. I think that either there's a God or there's not, obviously. If there's a God, nothing could be more important. If there's not a God, the whole issue of God is totally irrelevant and unimportant. As one who's fully convinced that there is a God and that he has not remained silent but has revealed himself through Christ, to me, you know, I can't think of anything that makes sense than to pursue him. Everything else I pursue, even a relationship or even serving humanity, everything I do is going to turn to dust. You know, everything I do is going to vanish. I'll be gone, and most of what I've accomplished will be gone shortly thereafter and forgotten. So, I mean, nothing in life is transtemporal other than that which is eternal.
Is transtemporal?
Temporal.
Oh, transtemporal. Okay.
We could say transtemporal, if that's a
gotcha.
Better way to say it.
Gotcha.
But yeah, everything is temporal. Yeah.
Except for the spirit.
What isn't. Yeah, what isn't is God and whatever he gives life to. I mean, we're not even immortal. The Bible says only God possesses immortality. We're not immortal.
Like you said, we even to our soul, our spiritual beings.
Right. Our spirit is not made immortal, but we can obtain immortality in Christ because he alone possesses it. And if we are in him, we share in his immortality. So the Bible says, whosoever believes in him will not perish, which is the other option, which means to be destroyed, but shall have everlasting life. So conditionally, believing on him puts us in a position to share in the immortality that is intrinsic in him. Apart from that, we're going to perish. We'll be destroyed.
Well, I could talk about this stuff for hours, but I'm curious. You've obviously done a lot of thinking about this, and I really enjoy watching some of the pathways that your brain has worn down and kind of made over it. It helps me kind of get a different perspective of it. But I'm curious, like, what are you doing now? You have your radio show, right? You said that's still on the air, which is The Narrow Path. What else, or mm-hmm. what's coming, or what goals do you have?
By the way, the website for that is thenarrowpath.com.
Okay, I'll put that in the notes.
Okay. Sure. But what else am I doing? Well, it's funny. People have asked me sometimes, what do you see yourself doing 5 years from now? I don't make plans for my future, never have. From the time I was young, I just said, I'm just going to do what the disciples did, follow Jesus and do whatever he puts in front of you. That's involved a lot of things. What's that?
I call that a choiceless existence.
Well, I make choices,
yes,
but I don't make agendas. I don't make agendas.
Yeah.
And
I should use that word instead.
Yeah. The it's an agendaless life.
Yes. I'm finding that right now. I'm working on figuring out how to do that.
Well, the one thing that all my activities have in common is they are all done to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness.
Okay.
And as Jesus said, all things will be added to you if you do that. So I began in a Christian rock band. I was a Christian cartoonist for many years. I did those things when I was young,
what
a teenager.
And what was 20. The band called?
We never recorded.
Oh, okay.
It was called New Line. And after it broke up, I was in other rock, Christian rock things, but we never recorded. But I mean, it's just what I did evangelistically. Then somebody offered me a campus. I ran a school for 16 years. Independently of that, somebody called me up and asked if I'd go and teach in Australia for Youth with a Mission, which I did. And that was 40 something years ago. And I've been doing it regularly since then all over the world. And then, you know, like I said, my friend who had a radio program I was sitting in for, he said, you should have a radio program. So he got me started in that in 1997. That's why I was still running the school. So I was doing the school and the radio show daily. And I closed the school in 99 and did the radio show and began to be what I do now, which is I've written several books. I have some social media influencing. I do my radio show is daily, an hour a day, week Monday through Friday. I've been doing that for 28 years.
Wow.
It's live. And then I also travel. sometime for Youth with a Mission, which is all over the world. But I also travel independently of that because my radio program is on radio stations all over the country. Mm. So I'm on like 70 to 80 radio stations around the country. And so people from there, from everywhere, invite me to come speak. So that actually this year, I'm 72. I'm 72 this month.
Happy birthday, almost.
Thanks. I haven't slowed down at all. In fact, this month, this is the fifth month of this year, obviously. I've traveled more in these 5 months than I have in most years. Mm. I spent a week teaching every day in Tennessee a couple months ago. Spent another week in the same month teaching every day in Arizona. The next month, which was April, I spent a week teaching every day up in Northern California. And then later in the same month, April, I spent a week in Texas speaking every day. And then I just got back this month from a week in the Seattle area teaching every day. I say a week, it's usually more like 10 days. Sometimes it's an actual week and more often 10 days. So I've been teaching in various venues. Most of these are homes, small venues. I don't have big crowds that follow my ministry, never have. Don't ever expect them to. But, you know, 30 or more people in a home is fairly typical. And and then some churches invite me of various denominations. I'm non-denominational. I'm not attached to any institutional church or any denomination.
Mm. Why do you do that? Why do you just go around speaking to people?
Because that's the next thing that opens up to me. You know, anything I can do to promote the kingdom of God or to, you know, spread the gospel is what I'm here to do.
And it's what you're good at.
I have no idea if I'll be on the radio next year. I mean, I probably will because increasing, not decreasing stations over the years. But I mean, I have no plan for my life. In fact, I don't know if I'll be alive tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nor does it concern me. I mean, it wouldn't concern me if I wouldn't.
That's fantastic.
What I'm doing, I'm living for eternity, but I'm trying to fill up my lifetime with things that I'll be glad I did. You know, when you reach the end of your life, if you have the opportunity to look back, and you know, that is if you're not killed suddenly and didn't know you're going to die. If you have time to reflect back on your life, there's going to be things you'll regret and things you'll be glad you did. I'm trying to do as many of the latter as possible, as few of the former. Mm. I think I'll die with few regrets, relatively few.
Yeah. Well, and to me, like your definition of morality, like my definition of sin is anything that you do that you know you shouldn't, and anything you don't do that you know you should. Like, it's just that simple. If you know you shouldn't do it and you do it, you're sinning. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It's sinning. That's really morality for me. And so if you have lived your each moment doing the thing that you know you should do, then how could you die with regrets?
I know. Well, I haven't done the thing I should do every moment. I mean, I've definitely had failures. I've had sins.
Right.
I've had
you're human.
Lapses, not in my faith, but in my behavior.
And in your understanding, like all kind, you're human. Like we are fallible. Yeah.
Yeah. I've lived a flawed life like everyone else, but I have aimed always in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. So let's just say that right now you found out that you had 15 seconds left to live and here you are recording. What would you want to say to the world? What is the most important thing to say or to hear?
I'd say Jesus Christ is the one that God has made king of the universe. And there's nothing wiser than to submit to him and do his will.
That's the most important thing to say.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Has eternal consequences. Not much else does.
Yeah. Well, normally, or at least in a lot of conversations up till now, every conversation is different. Each one is the first one. But normally I ask a lot of questions about past life and like who you were as a kid. I like to get into that mind and see what it was like. But it feels like that's a conversation for another time, maybe. What else do you have? Like, is there anything else on your mind or that you want to say or explore?
Most of the things I think are important to me have actually come up already in this conversation, so I'm good with it.
Perfect.
I appreciate it.
Perfect. Likewise. And I feel really, really appreciative that you just like explored all this stuff. Like, this is just very satisfying for me.
Well, it's my pleasure, Michael. I appreciate you calling or having me do this. Blessings.
lot of love and deep thanks to Buddy Anderson for his original music and audio engineering. This podcast sounds the way that it does because of his heart and the way that he listens. Explore his sound at From Another Mista on Spotify. Well worth the listen. And to Angela Cook, our producer, thanks for holding the vision, weaving the threads, and helping every episode land with clarity and care. To every one of you who's subscribed, listened, shared, or just felt something along the way, thank you. You're part of this too. Your attention is sacred. I don't take it lightly. Stay curious. I'll see you next time.